Chapter 7. Healing the Wound. Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. You better let somebody love you before it's too late. The Eagles, from Desperado. The task of healing is to respect oneself as a creature, no more and no less. Wendell Berry. The deepest desire of our hearts is for union with God. God created us for union with Himself. This is the original purpose of our lives. Brennan Manning. I think I've given you the wrong impression of my life with my sons. Rock climbing, canoeing, wrestling, our quest for danger and destruction. You might get the impression we're a sort of military academy of the backwoods or one of those militia cults. So let me tell you of my favorite event of the day. It comes late in the evening. At bedtime, after the boys have brushed their teeth and we've said our family prayers. As I'm tucking them in, one of my boys will ask, "Dad, can we snuggle tonight?" Snuggle time is when I'll cuddle up next to one of them on a bed that's not really big enough for both of us. And that's the point, to get very close. And there in the dark, we'll just sort of talk. Usually we start laughing and then we have to whisper because the others will ask us to keep it down in there. Sometimes it breaks into tickling, other times it's a chance for them to ask some serious questions about life. But whatever happens, what matters most is what's going on beneath all that. Intimacy. Closeness. Connection. Yes, my boys want me to guide them into adventure, and they love to test their strength against mine. But all of that takes place in the context of an intimate bond of love that is far deeper than words can express. What they want more than anything, what I love to offer them more than anything, is soul-to-soul oneness. As Tom Wolfe said, the deepest search in life, it seemed to me, the thing that in one way or another was central to all living, was man's search to find a father, not merely the father of his flesh, not merely the lost father of his youth, but the image of a strength and wisdom external to his need and superior to his hunger, to which the belief and power of his own life could be united from the story of a novel. Guys are unanimously embarrassed by their emptiness and woundedness. It is, for most of us, a tremendous source of shame, as I've said. But it need not be. From the very beginning, back before the fall and the assault, ours was meant to be a desperately dependent existence. It's like a tree and its branches, explains Christ. You are the branches, I am the trunk. From me you draw your life. That's how it was meant to be. In fact, he goes on to say, apart from me, you can do nothing. John 15:5. He's not berating us or mocking us or even saying it with a sigh, all the while thinking, I wish they'd pull it together and stop needing me so much. Not at all. We are made to depend on God. We are made for union with Him, and nothing about us works right without it. As C.S. Lewis wrote, a car is made to run on gasoline, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on Himself. He Himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. This is where our sin and our culture have come together to keep us in bondage and brokenness, to prevent the healing of our wound. Our sin is that stubborn part inside that wants, above all else, to be independent. There's a part of us fiercely committed to living in a way where we do not have to depend on anyone, especially God. Then culture comes along with figures like John Wayne and James Bond and all those other real men. And the one thing they have in common is that they're loners. They don't need anyone. We come to believe deep in our hearts that needing anyone for anything is a sort of weakness, a handicap. This is why a man never, ever stops to ask for directions. I'm notorious for this. I know how to get there. I'll find my own way, thank you very much. Only when I am fully and finally and completely lost will I pull over and get some help, and I'll feel like a wimp for doing it. Jesus knew nothing of that. The man who never flinched to take on hypocrites and get in their face, the one who drove 100 men with a bundle of cords swung free, the master of wind and sea, lived in a desperate dependence on his Father. I assure you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He does only what he sees the Father doing. I live by the power of the living Father who sent me. The words I say are not my own, but my Father who lives in me does his work through me. This isn't a source of embarrassment to Christ. Quite the opposite. He brags about his relationship with his father. He's happy to tell anyone who will listen, the father and I are one. Why is this important? Because so many men I know live with a deep misunderstanding of Christianity. They look at it as a second chance to get their act together. They've been forgiven, now they see it as their job to get with the program. They're trying to finish the marathon with a broken leg. But follow this closely. You'll recall that masculinity is an essence that is passed from father to son. That is a picture, as so many things in life are, of a deeper reality. The true essence of strength is passed to us from God through our union with Him. Notice what a deep and vital part of King David's life this is. Remembering that he is a man's man, a warrior for sure, listen to how he describes his relationship to God in the Psalms. I love you, O Lord, my strength. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O my strength, come quickly to help me. O my strength, I watch for you. You, O God, are my fortress, my loving God. I dare say that David could take on John Wayne or James Bond any day. Yet this true man is unashamed to admit his desperate dependence on God. We know we are meant to embody strength. We know we are not what we were meant to be. And so we feel our brokenness as a source of shame. As we spoke of his wound recently and how he needed to enter into it for healing, Dave protested, "I don't even want to go there. It all feels so true." Men are typically quite harsh with the broken places within them. Many report feeling as though there is a boy inside, and they despise that about themselves. "Quit being such a baby," they order themselves. But that is not how God feels. He is furious about what's happened to you. It would be better to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around the neck than to face the punishment in store for harming one of these little ones. Luke 17:2. Think of how you would feel if the wounds you were given, the blows dealt to you, were dealt to a boy you loved, your son perhaps. Would you shame him for it? Would you feel scorn that he couldn't rise above it all? No, you'd feel compassion. As Gerald Manley Hopkins wrote, "My own heart, let me more have pity on. Let me live to my sad self hereafter kind." In the movie Good Will Hunting, there is a beautiful picture of what can happen when a man realizes he has owned his wound and discovers he doesn't have to. Will Hunting, played by Matt Damon, is a brilliant young man, a genius, who works as a janitor at MIT and lives in a rough part of town. No one knows about his gift because he hides it behind a false self of tough kid from the wrong side of the tracks. He's a fighter, a violent man. That false self was born out of a father wound. His original father he does not know, and the man who was his foster father would come home drunk and beat Will mercilessly. After he's arrested for getting into a brawl for the umpteenth time, Will is ordered by the court to see a psychologist, Sean, played by Robin Williams. They form a bond. For the first time in Will's life, an older man cares about him deeply. His initiation has begun. Toward the end of one of their last sessions, Sean and Will are talking about the beatings he endured, now recorded in his case file. Will. So, what is it like? Will has attachment disorder? Is it all that stuff? Fear of abandonment? Is that why I broke up with Skylar? Sean. I didn't know you had. I did. You want to talk about it? No. Hey, Will, I don't know a lot, but you see this? Holding his file. This is not your fault. Yeah, I know that. Look at me, son. It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault. I know. No, you don't. It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault. All right. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Don't mess with me, Sean. Not you. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Will collapses into his arms, weeping. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It is no shame that you need healing. It is no shame to look to another for strength. It is no shame that you feel young and afraid inside. It's not your fault. Frederick Buechner's father committed suicide when he was 10. He left a note to his mother. "I adore and love you, and am no good. Give Freddie my watch. Give Jamie my pearl pin. I give you all my love. And then he sat in the garage while the running car filled it with carbon monoxide. It happened on a Saturday morning in the fall. He was to have taken Frederick and his brother to a football game that day. Instead, he took himself forever from their lives. What is a 10-year-old boy to do with such an event? Buechner says in The Sacred Journey, a child takes life as it comes because he has no other way of taking it. The world had come to an end that Saturday morning, but each time we had moved to another place, I had seen a world come to an end, and there had always been another world to replace it. When somebody you love dies, Mark Twain said, it is like when your house burns down. It isn't for years that you realize the full extent of your loss. For me, it was longer than for most, if indeed I have realized it fully even yet. And in the meantime, the loss came to get buried so deep in me that after a time, I scarcely ever took it out to look at it at all, let alone speak of it. This is the way we are with our wound, especially men. We bury it deep and never take it out again. But take it out we must, or better, enter into it. I entered my wound through the surprising door of my anger. After we moved to Colorado, about 11 years ago, I found myself snapping at my boys for silly things. A spilled glass of milk would elicit a burst of rage. Whoa, John, I thought. There are things going on inside. You'd better have a look under the hood. As I explored my anger with the help of my dear friend, Brent, I realized I was so furious about feeling all alone in a world that constantly demanded more of me than I felt able to give. Something in me felt young, like a 10-year-old boy in a man's world, but without a man's ability to come through. There was much fear beneath the surface. Fear that I would fail, fear that I would be found out, finally, fear that I was ultimately on my own. Where did all this fear come from, I wondered. Why do I feel so alone in the world, and so young inside? Why does something in my heart feel orphaned? My answer came through several movies. As I've written about in other places, I was blindsided by A River Runs Through It, because through its beautiful retelling of boys who never really had their father except through their fishing trips, and how in the end they lost even that. I realized I had lost my father, and like Buechner, the loss got buried so deep in me that after a time I scarcely ever took it out. I was pierced by a perfect world because I saw there just how much a boy's father means to him and how I longed for that intimacy with a source of strength who loved me and could tell me my name. I so identified with Will Hunting because I, too, was a fighter who saw myself as up against the rest of the world, and I had also accepted my wound and never grieved it. I thought it was my fault. In some ways, God had to sneak up on me through those stories because I wasn't willing to just skip happily down the path to my heart's deepest pain. We fight this part of the journey. The whole false self, our lifestyle, is an elaborate defense against entering our wounded heart. It is a chosen blindness. Our false self stubbornly blinds each of us to the light and the truth of our own emptiness and hollowness, says Manning. There are readers who even now have no idea what their wound is, or even what false self arose from it. How convenient that blindness is, blissful ignorance. But a wound unfelt is a wound unhealed. We must go in. The door may be your anger. It may be rejection that you've experienced, perhaps from a girl. It may be failure or the loss of the golden bat and the way that God is thwarting your false self. It may be a simple prayer. Jesus, take me into my wound. Behold, he says, I stand at the door and knock. If you wanted to learn how to heal the blind and you thought that following Christ around and watching how he did it would make things clear, you'd wind up pretty frustrated. He never does it the same way twice. He spits on one guy. For another, he spits on the ground and makes mud and puts that on his eyes. To a third, he simply speaks. A fourth, he touches. And a fifth, he kicks out a demon. There are no formulas with God. The way in which God heals our wound is a deeply personal process. He is a person, and he insists on working personally. For some, it comes in a moment of divine touch. For others, it takes place over time and through the help of another, maybe several others. As Agnes Sanford says, there are in many of us wounds so deep that only the mediation of someone else to whom we may bear our grief can heal us. So much healing took place in my life simply through my friendship with Brent. We were partners, but far more than that, we were friends. We spent hours together fly fishing, backpacking, hanging out in pubs, just spending time with a man I truly respected, a real man who loved and respected me. Nothing heals quite like that. At first, I feared that I was fooling him, that he'd see through it any day and drop me. But he didn't. And what happened instead was validation. My heart knew that if a man I know as a man thinks I'm one too, well, then maybe I am one after all. Remember, masculinity is bestowed by masculinity. But there have been other significant ways in which God has worked. Times of healing prayer, times of grieving the wound and forgiving my father. Most of all, times of deep communion with God. The point is this. Healing never happens outside of intimacy with Christ. The healing of our wound flows out of our union with Him. But there are some common themes that I share with you as you seek the restoration of your heart. The first step seems so simple, it's almost hard to believe we overlook it, never ask for it, and when we do, we sometimes struggle for days just to get the words out. It begins with surrender. As Lewis says, until you have given yourself to Him, you will not have a real self. We return the branch to its trunk. We yield our lives to the one who is our life. And then we invite Jesus into the wound. We ask Him to come and meet us there, to enter into the broken and unhealed places of our heart. When the Bible tells us that Christ came to redeem mankind, it offers a whole lot more than forgiveness. To simply forgive a broken man is like telling someone running a marathon, "It's okay that you've broken your leg. I won't hold that against you. Now finish the race." That is cruel, to leave him disabled that way. No, there is much more to our redemption. The core of Christ's mission is foretold in Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me, to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release for the prisoners. The Messiah will come, he says, to bind up and heal, to release and set free. What? Your heart. Christ comes to restore and release you, your soul, the true you. This is the central passage in the entire Bible about Jesus, the one he chooses to quote about himself when he steps into the spotlight in Luke 4 and announces his arrival. So take him at his word. Ask him in to heal all the broken places within you and unite them into one whole and healed heart. Ask Him to release you from all bondage and captivity, as He promised to do. As MacDonald prayed, "Gather my broken fragments to a whole. Let mine be a merry, all-receiving heart, but make it a whole, with light in every part." But you can't do this at a distance. You can't ask Christ to come into your wound while you remain far from it. You have to go there with Him. That is why we must grieve the wound. It was not your fault, and it did matter. Oh, what a milestone day that was for me when I simply allowed myself to say that the loss of my father mattered. The tears that flowed were the first I'd ever granted my wound, and they were deeply healing. All those years of sucking it up melted away in my grief. It is so important for us to grieve our wound. It is the only honest thing to do. For in grieving, we admit the truth, that we were hurt by someone we loved, that we lost something very dear. And it hurts us very much. Tears are healing. They help to open and cleanse the wound. As Augustine wrote in his Confessions, "The tears streamed down, and I let them flow as freely as they would, making of them a pillow for my heart. On them it rested." Grief is a form of validation. It says the wound mattered. We let God love us. We let Him get real close to us. I know, it seems painfully obvious, but I'm telling you, few men are ever so vulnerable as to simply let themselves be loved by God. After Brad lost his plan for redemption, I asked him, "Brad, why don't you just let God love you?" He squirmed in his chair. I had such a hard time with that, just being loved. It feels so naked. I'd rather be in control, be admired for what I bring to the group. Later, he wrote this in a letter to me. "After it all came crashing down, I was overwhelmed by sadness and grief. The pain is incredible. In the midst of that, God asked me, 'Brad, will you let me love you?' I know what He is asking. I feel anxious that I need to go email all these schools and secure a future. But I'm tired of running away. I want to come home. I flipped through my Bible and came to John 15. Just as the Father has loved you, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. The battle is very intense. At times, it is all clear. At others, it is a fog. Right now, all I can do is cling to Jesus as best I know how and not run from all that is in my heart. Abiding in the love of God is our only hope, the only true home for our hearts. It's not that we mentally acknowledge that God loves us. It's that we let our hearts come home to Him and stay in His love. MacDonald says it this way. When our hearts turn to Him, that is opening the door to Him. Then He comes in, not by our thought only, not in our idea only, but He comes Himself and of His own will. Thus the Lord, the Spirit, becomes the soul of our souls. Then indeed we are. Then indeed we have life. The life of Jesus has become life in us. We are one with God forever and ever. Or as St. John of the Cross echoes, Oh, how gently and how lovingly dost thou lie awake in the depth and center of my soul, where thou in secret and in silence alone, as its sole Lord, abidest, not only as in thine own house or in thine own chamber, but also as within my own bosom, in close and intimate union. From Living Flame of Love. This deep, intimate union with Jesus and with His Father is the source of all our healing and all our strength. It is, as Leanne Payne says, the central and unique truth of Christianity. After a retreat in which I laid out the masculine journey to a small group of men, I received this email. My father never left. He just never had time for me or words of encouragement. He has spent his entire life making himself the center of attention. For the first time, I understand why I am highly driven, why I never let anyone get close to me, including my wife, and why I am an imposter to most people. I broke down and cried. I feel the presence of God in my heart like I have never felt Him before. The beginning of a new heart. Time has come for us to forgive our fathers. Paul warns us that unforgiveness and bitterness can wreck our lives and the lives of others. I am sorry to think of all the years my wife endured the anger and bitterness that I redirected at her from my father. As someone has said, forgiveness is setting a prisoner free and then discovering the prisoner was you. I found some help in Bly's experience of forgiving his own father when he said, I began to think of him not as someone who had deprived me of love or attention or companionship, but as someone who himself had been deprived by his father and his mother and by the culture. My father had his own wound that no one ever offered to heal. His father was an alcoholic too, for a time, and there were some hard years for my dad as a young man, just as there were for me. Now, you must understand, forgiveness is a choice. It is not a feeling, but an act of the will. As Neil Anderson has written, don't wait to forgive until you feel like forgiving. You'll never get there. Feelings take time to heal after the choice to forgive is made. We allow God to bring the hurt up from our past, for if your forgiveness doesn't visit the emotional core of your life, it will be incomplete. We acknowledge that it hurt, that it mattered, and we choose to extend forgiveness to our Father. That is not saying it didn't really matter. It is not saying I probably deserved part of it anyway. Forgiveness says it was wrong, it mattered, and I release you. And then we ask God to father us and to tell us our true name. I noticed a few years ago, a ways into my own masculine journey, that I related well to Jesus and to God, but not to God as Father. It's not hard to figure out why. Father has been a source of pain and disappointment to me, to many of us. Then I read this in MacDonald. In my own childhood and boyhood, my father was the refuge from all the ills of life, even sharp pain itself. Therefore, I say to son or daughter who has no pleasure in the name Father, you must interpret the word by all that you have missed in life, all that human tenderness can give or desire in the nearness and readiness of love, all and infinitely more must be true of the perfect Father, of the Maker of fatherhood. The gift was perfectly timed, for I knew it was time to allow God to father me. All along the process of my initiation, God has provided words like that, messages, people, gifts to open the next leg of the journey. Masculinity is passed from father to son, and then from father to son. Adam, Abraham, Jacob, David, Jesus. They all learned who they were out of their intimacy with God, with the Father. After all, who can give a man this, his own name? God alone. For no one but God sees what the man is. This is usually thought of with a sense of guilt. Yes, God sees me, and what he sees is my sin. That's wrong on two counts. First off, your sin has been dealt with. Your Father has removed it from you as far as the east is from the west. Psalm 103:12. Your sins have been washed away. 1 Corinthians 6:11. When God looks at you, he does not see your sin. He has not one condemning thought toward you. Romans 8:1. But that's not all. You have a new heart. That's the promise of the new covenant. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Ezekiel 36:26-27. There's a reason that it's called good news. Too many Christians today are living back in the old covenant. They've had Jeremiah 17:9 drilled into them, and they walk around believing, my heart is deceitfully wicked. Not anymore, it's not. Read the rest of the book. In Jeremiah 31:33, God announces the cure for all that. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. I will give you a new heart. That's why Paul says in Romans 2:29, no, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart, by the Spirit. Sin is not the deepest thing about you. You have a new heart. Did you hear me? Your heart is good. What God sees when he sees you is the real you, the true you, the man he had in mind when he made you. How else could he give you the white stone with your true name on it? I brought you along in Dave's story, how his father dealt him the wound of Mama's Boy, how he sought his sense of masculinity through women, how he embraced his wound and its message as final and true. We sat together one day in my office, his life pretty well detailed and unpacked before us, as if we had unpacked the trunk of secrets and laid them all out to the light of day. What else was there to say? You've only got one hope, Dave, that your dad was wrong about you. You must ask God what he thinks of you, and you must stay with the question until you have an answer. The battle will get fierce here. This is the last thing the evil one wants you to know. He will play the ventriloquist. He'll whisper to you as if he were the voice of God. Remember, he's the accuser of the brethren. Revelation 12:10. After I saw Gladiator, I so longed to be a man like Maximus. He reminded me of Henry V from Shakespeare's play, a courageous, valiant man. Maximus is strong and courageous, and he fights so well. Yet his heart is given over to eternity. He yearns for heaven, but stays to fight so that others might be free. I wept at the end, pierced by a longing to be like him. Satan was all over that, telling me that no, I was really Commodus, that conniving wretch who plays the villain in the movie. What made that blow so hard to shake is the fact that I once was Commodus. I was a selfish, conniving man who manipulated everything for my own benefit. That was a long time ago, but the accusation stung. I left for a trip to England where I did 4 conferences in 5 days. It was a brutal trip, and I was under a great deal of spiritual attack. What a relief it was to slump into my seat and catch my plane home. Tired to the bone, spent and beat up, I needed to hear words from my father. So I began to pour my heart out to him in my journal. What of me, dear Lord? Are you pleased? What did you see? I'm sorry that I have to ask, wishing I knew without asking. Fear, I suppose, makes me doubt. Still, I yearn to hear from you a word or image, a name, or even just a glance from you. This is what I heard. You are Henry V after Agincourt, the man in the arena whose face is covered with blood and sweat and wet and dust, who strove valiantly, a great warrior. Yes, even Maximus. And then, you are my friend. I cannot tell you how much those words mean to me. In fact, I'm embarrassed to tell them to you. They seem arrogant. But I share them in hopes that they will help you find your own. They are words of life, words that heal my wound and shatter the enemy's accusations. I am grateful for them, deeply grateful. Oh, what wondrous stories I could tell here of how many times God has spoken to me and to other men since we've been asking the question. My friend Aaron went to a park near our home and found a place of solitude. There, he waited for the Father's voice. What he first heard was this: true masculinity is spiritual. Aaron has for so long felt that spirituality was feminine. It put him in a terrible bind because he is a very spiritual man and yet longs to be a real man. God spoke exactly what he needed to hear. Masculinity is spiritual. Then he heard, true spirituality is good. And then, you are a man. You are a man. You are a man. It's a battle to get to this place, and once words like this have been spoken, the enemy rushes in to steal them. Remember how he assaulted Christ in the wilderness, right on the heels of hearing words from his Father? Another friend and I were talking about these stories and many more like them. He sort of sighed and said, "Yes, I remember a time in church when I heard God say to me, 'You're doing great. I'm proud of you, right where you are.' But I could not believe it. It just doesn't seem true." That is why we always rest on propositional truth. We stand on what Scripture says about us. We are forgiven. Our heart is good. The Father's voice is never condemning. From that place, we ask God to speak personally to us, to break the power of the lie that was delivered with our wound. He knows your name. I have a favorite painting in my office, a reprint of Charlie Schrevogel's My Bunkie. It's a scene of four cavalry soldiers done in the Western style of Remington. The action is a rescue. One of the riders has apparently been shot off his horse, and three men are galloping in to pick him up. In the foreground, the stranded soldier is being swept up onto the back of the horse of his bunkmate, his bunkie, while the other two are providing rifle cover. I love this scene because that is what I want to do and be. I want to ride to the rescue of those who have been shot down. But sitting in my office one day, God began to speak to me about the painting and my role in it. You cannot be the man who rescues John until you are the man without a horse, the man who needs rescuing. Yes, true strength does not come out of bravado. Until we are broken, our life will be self-centered, self-reliant. Our strength will be our own. So long as you think you are really something in and of yourself, what will you need God for? I don't trust a man who hasn't suffered. I don't let a man get close to me who hasn't faced his wound. Think of the posers you know. Are they the kind of man you would call at 2 a.m. when life is collapsing around you? Not me. I don't want cliches. I want deep, soulful truth, and that only comes when a man has walked the road I've been talking about. As Buechner says, to do for yourself the best thing that you have it in you to do, to grit your teeth and clench your fists in order to survive the world at its harshest and worst, is, by that very act, to be unable to let something be done for you and in you that is more wonderful still. The trouble with steeling yourself against the harshness of reality is that the same steel that secures your life against being destroyed secures your life also against being opened up and transformed. Only when we enter our wound will we discover our true glory. As Bly says, where a man's wound is, that is where his genius will be. There are two reasons for this. First, because the wound was given in the place of your true strength as an effort to take you out. Until you go there, you are still posing, offering something more shallow and insubstantial. And therefore, second, it is out of your brokenness that you discover what you have to offer the community. The false self is never wholly false. Those gifts we've been using are often quite true about us, but we've used them to hide behind. We thought that the power of our life was in the golden bat, but the power is in us. When we begin to offer not merely our gifts, but our true selves, that is when we become powerful. That is when we are ready for battle.